The G20 summit of the world's leading nations has broken up without agreement on how to deal with the situation in Syria. David Cameron says there was never any chance of a consensus being reached in St. Petersburg. President Vladimir Putin is still insisting Russia will not back America's plans for military action. He says many countries at the summit agree with him.
Russia, China, India, Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, Italy, all spoke against military action. Also, the same was done by the General Secretary of the United Nations.
The Unite Union has been cleared of trying to fix the selection process for a parliamentary candidate in Falkirk. But despite doing nothing wrong, Carrie Murphy, who was backed by Unite, is withdrawing from the race for the seat. A new recording's emerged of a phone call made by the driver of a crashed Spanish train just moments after the derailment. In it, Francisco José Garzón tells a colleague he was travelling at more than twice the speed limit. Coronation Street's Michael Lavelle says conversations he had about a little secret were not about abusing a girl. At his child sex abuse trial, the actor says the secret was that he'd cheated on his wife. The first of tonight's World Cup qualifying action is underway, with Gareth Bale on the bench for Wales away to Macedonia. That's goalless in the early stages. Scotland can't reach next summer's finals, but are hoping for another improved performance against a strong Belgium side. But Strachan says they can set out a template of how they'd like to approach the game in the future.
Looking at every opportunity to go forward. Looking at our good players to take people on. And then when we lose the ball, have a good shape, which makes it difficult for great players to play.
Later, the Republic of Ireland hosts Sweden, and Northern Ireland play Portugal. England face Moldova at Wembley too. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove, Sylvia Dubell. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we hear from the big hitters in the blue corner, Skull and Bones club member John Kerry, and in the red corner for Russia, Vladimir Putin. Also, what do US veterans think about it all? Are they anxious to finish the job in Syria? Or have they had enough of fighting wars of aggression in faraway lands? And the BBC airs a documentary about respectable European business leaders helping Nazi war criminals to escape in the late 1940s to set up a Fourth Reich financial empire. Did you miss that one? Well, it aired on BBC Radio 4 as part of their Documents series back in 2008, so we have some clips in case you missed it. And as Germany splashes out to restore the Nuremberg Stadium where Hitler held his famous rallies, we ask, what were the rallies really all about? And is this a good way to spend public money? Plus, Martin Summers at the G20 in St. Petersburg, all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, some light rain, highs of 16 this weekend, sunnier on Saturday, cloudier on Sunday with a few light showers. Next week, highs up again to 20, plenty of sunshine, but also cloudiness and light showers. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of September, highs of 16 Celsius, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove, Sylvia Dubell. Hi, Sylvia. Welcome to Drive Time.
Yeah, hello there.
Now, first of all, your leader of the actual group is Tim Kent, but you've got Simon Cook, haven't you, actually on the cabinet. How does that work? Just how does the work amongst the politicians, amongst the councillors, when you've got a leader who's the leader of the group and you've also got somebody who's in on these big decisions being made by the cabinet with George Ferguson?
Well, that was something we actually wanted. We didn't want the leader of the group to be on the cabinet. We thought that was going to be very divisive, and it allows us much more freedom and latitude to make our own decisions. We don't have to go with what George Ferguson and his cabinet are doing. We are our own people, and Tim Kent makes sure we do that. Now, Simon Cook obviously will have to go along with the policies that the that George wants, but he doesn't necessarily have to vote with that. But we keep a completely independent line from the cabinet because we are a completely independent group.
But it sounds almost like you've got two leaders.
Oh, absolutely not. We have one leader, definitely. Simon is, there's no way that Simon is the leader. He takes a very much a back seat in this. Tim is very much the leader and a very good leader at that.
Okay. Also, your role, how long have you been a councillor for and what committees are you sitting on at the moment?
Well, here I've been a councillor for 3 years. I've been a councillor elsewhere for many years.
Where's that, Sylvia? Where are you from?
Well, originally I was a councillor in the London Borough of Sutton, like 34 years ago. Then I was also a Wiltshire town councillor for Chippenham, a North Wiltshire district councillor and a Wiltshire county councillor.
Sounds like you've been slowly edging your way westwards, haven't you, from London to Bristol?
Oh, I tried further westwards. I lived in Wales for 12 years, but I was never going to get elected yet there because A, I was a woman, B, I was the wrong party, I had to be Plaid Cymru, or Labour, but mainly Plaid Cymru. I was in a Welsh area, and my Welsh didn't sound Welsh, even though I learned it still sounded English. So.
What parties were you standing for in those other places, Sutton, for example?
I've been a liberal for my whole life.
Okay, so why the Liberal Party? Why is that sort of, why does it float your boat? How?
I guess I'm a liberal in my heart, really. I do believe that the basic thing of right is that we're all equal among equals, and that fairness and justice is the most important thing. It doesn't seem to happen that way, but I've always worked out that I'm no better than anyone else and they're no better than me.
Because, I mean, many of the changes that are being brought through with this Liberal Conservative coalition government aren't like that at all. In fact, they're in reverse. What is happening is many of the richest are being rewarded and the poorest, people can least afford it, are having money taken away from them. I'm thinking of things like the welfare reforms, the bedroom tax, money being taken away from disabled people, this kind of thing. It sounds like, I mean, your ideal is something completely different to what's actually happening in politics.
Well, good things have happened. I mean, there is the £10,000 income tax threshold that's coming up. The other very good Liberal Democrat policy that has been incredibly beneficial in my ward particularly is the pupil premium, which since I'm a governor of a school where over 50% of my children are on free school meals, and the Liberal Democrat pupil premium has benefited that. It's going to be £9,000 per pupil this coming year. That is an enormous amount of money to be pumped into, so it's not all quite the way you've put it.
What about committees then? What committees are you on in the city?
I only sit now on the Development Control North. Previously I had been on the Overview and Scrutiny Management and also on the Adult Health and Social Care, but due to health problems I've had to step down from those, and also having personal problems with at home with my husband.
What about the committee? Why is that? Because you're a South Bristol councillor, but you're on the North Development Committee. Sounds as if it would make much more sense if you were making decisions, planning decisions about South Bristol, because that's the area you know.
No, that's
and you can represent the people who voted for you better.
I can still represent them rather much better. The difficulty is that if you're tied into the committee, you can't express an opinion in advance, and it seems to me really important that when we've got a planning thing coming up in my ward, I can actually say yes, I like it, or no, I really hate it. And if I do that and I'm on that committee, then I'm stuffed, I can't say anything, and so I'm not prepared to sort of predetermine something. So staying off that committee allows me then to go along to committee as the councillor and say what I think and campaign in whatever way I want.
So is this some sort of gagging clause? Because I'm very surprised to hear that councillors are not allowed to express their opinion.
Oh, it's absolutely, it's a quasi-judicial committee, and this is government ruling. You cannot express an opinion in advance of a planning decision. If you sit on that committee, that is called predetermination, and until you hear all the evidence at that committee, you cannot and must not make a decision
on
that.
But you could be persuaded, couldn't you? I mean, you might think one thing a few weeks beforehand and then something else a few weeks after.
Absolutely, but when you actually get to the committee, you've got to go there with an open mind and listen to the evidence that's put forward to you. You can say, if you want, on the evidence I know at the moment, but that's a pretty poor way of doing it, and I prefer to be able to make comments on my ward without having to be involved in the committee, when in fact I can go along to that committee and say what I want on the day.
But surely there's a certain silliness about all that, in that you have to pretend that you don't have an opinion. I mean, of course the councillors will have an opinion, they're just not allowed to speak it.
Well, that's government policy. This is the quasi-judicial thing, and you can end up by going to the standards board, and that really is just not worth it. So.
Okay, so this is something that they would then interrogate you, saying, hang on a minute, you said something before this planning committee meeting, therefore the decision is invalid.
You'd already made up your mind when you voted, and you know.
Sounds to me like councillors are being tongue-tied by that, but anyway, what about you can say, that is decisions that have been made? What have you been discussing recently on that committee?
Well, it's been fairly quiet of late, but the worst aspects I sit on Development Control North, are these very large applications for the cricket ground and the football ground for redevelopment for Sainsbury's, and also we've been having developments for yet more power stations up in Avonmouth, and so it's only the really controversial things that actually come to committee. 95% of all applications are done by delegation now.
Well, what about the decisions to do with the cricket ground and Sainsbury's? I mean, these are really hot potatoes.
Absolutely.
Politically. What sort of pressure is on you in different directions to vote one way or another?
Well, there's huge pressure. You're lobbied endlessly, and there is huge pressure. But most of these are described as enabling sort of developments. So to enable the cricket club to have one day matches, for instance, they had to have the bigger stand, and they had to get the money for that, they had to have housing, and you have to make a decision in your mind whether, and the other one with the Sainsbury's particularly, you have to decide whether to enable them to do that, and then particularly with the football, to build their stadium completely in a different place, was going to have a major effect on the largest shopping street in the whole of Europe, the largest independent shopping street in Europe. And so you listen to all the arguments, and you have to try and make a decision on how you're going to go on that.
Not always easy, I would imagine. Do you find that afterwards people are blaming you? And because, I mean, there's a lot of pressure on. It can make a massive change, particularly with a big supermarket. If you go to it down to just as far as somewhere like Shepton Mallet, where you can see that the massive developments that have happened there have completely sucked all the life, almost all of the life, out of the high street. It can completely devastate if you get things wrong, can't it?
It's quite difficult. I think when you have to actually vote, and the actual meetings are a bit like gladiatorial things. You get huge numbers of supporters all in their kind of club colours with their arms crossed, hissing you if you say something you don't like, and cheering when something is said. And it is quite difficult, if you're going to vote against it, to have the courage to put your hand up. I have to say, on the football ground one, I voted against it, but I was the only one who did. Several others abstained, but it went through. I mean, it went through because other people thought that the football club, or it's the rugby club, needed its ground so much more out on the edge of Bristol that it was worth having a whopping great Sainsbury's there. But I could see that the shopping street, the Gloucester Road, is an incredibly important independent shopping street for Bristol, and I could just see the life just going from it. And when I listened to all the arguments, it was clear to me, but it appeared to me I was the only one it was clear to.
It seems to me there's quite a lot of pressure on councillors, especially when there's so much money at stake.
There's huge pressure, because I think the other thing, we're not really helped, well, the press. I mean, when there was the other Sainsbury's decision in Bedminster and we had votes there, the press put all our photos there and called us kind of hypocrites. I mean, it's pretty dreadful.
You're talking about the Bristol Post now.
Yes. I'm talking about
the
Bristol Post.
Because we're not all the same.
No, and that is quite hard to have your photo there.
Especially when you've got some of the business interests that have got an interest in that planning decision, who are mates and pally handshakers with the people at the bosses of the Evening Post, or the Bristol Post, or whatever they call it now.
That's right.
fascinating. Anyway, real insight into the planning and development of the city, because some of these decisions, I mean, people think the planning system is boring, but somebody like you, Sylvia, needs to be in there defending our city from these rampaging developers sometimes. And other times, of course, they're doing good things.
Well, it's an exciting committee, actually. Yes.
Planning is exciting. Yes. We've heard it here first. Martin, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Let's go straight to the problem with the Labour Party this week. I want an explanation, please, as to what on earth is going on, because Ed Miliband seems to have not only shot himself in the foot, but shot himself in the head almost over this business with Falkirk, and saying we don't really like the arrangement with the trade unions, and of course they're now pulling the funding on the Labour Party.
Well, I suppose, I mean, obviously from a sort of, you know, tactical point of view, that we need this kind of row like a hole in the head.
Yes, exactly, as I was saying.
But at the same time, I think the issue of how party politics in this country is funded is not going to go away. I mean, what you've got in the United States of America is the Supreme Court has just decided, they've passed a law that anybody can put any amount of money into any political campaign, and they don't even have to say who they are or what they've spent the money
on. You know
on.
What that means? That means you can transfer money from a numbered Swiss bank account straight into a political party.
That's right, that's right.
Sylvia's looking at me as if to say, I hope they do
I mean, the money in US politics is always, you know, not just spoken, it swears, but I mean, they've pushed it even further down that road. But of course, if you look across the North Sea to Scandinavia, all Scandinavian countries after the war decided that they were going to have political parties were going to be funded by the state.
We aren't most European
Most Northern European Scandinavian social democracies, that is the general rule.
Maybe there's a bit of pressure from the EU for us to start getting into line. What do you think?
I think the point is that if you look, Britain, if we got rid of our imperial heritage and stopped trying to boss the world around, we're a middle-sized European country, a bit like, you know,
we're a little island, apparently.
Yes, I mean, but we ought to be modelling ourselves on countries like Denmark, Sweden, Norway. That's the kind of country we ought to be, and we would be if we hadn't got this, you know, this imperialist.
So do you think Miliband's being sort of quite clever here? He's saying, well, if we sever the connection with the unions and make it more difficult for the unions to fund the Labour Party, then we can make a case in the run up to the next election for political funding by the state.
What seems to be happening is that the unions, the unions are basically saying, if you don't want our money, we won't give it you, but you won't have any then, will you? And the Liberal Democrats, of course, that you've got your funders, you know, some of your people that funded you turned out to be, you know, crooks and what have you, and this is the problem with funding it through donations by whoever. And of course we all know the Conservative Party is basically funded by the City of London. That's it. We bail out the City of London, the City of London then funds the Conservative Party to carry on bailing out the City of London. That's the reality.
Well, it's Labour that bailed out the City of
London.
Labour funded the Tory Party.
What Tony Blair was trying to do, it is all about money at the end of the day. As the polls say, I used to live in Poland, if you don't know what it's about the money. What Blair was trying to do was make the Labour Party more dependent on donations from people like Lord Sainsbury than on the unions. So, in other words, he's trying to liberate the Labour Party from the unions, as he would see it, so that in actual fact, you know, the unions won't have any real say in party policies, as they don't really. I mean, they've not got anything in the last generation from the party leadership. In Germany, the Deutsche Gewerkschaftsbund, the German trade unions, do not fund the SPD, the Socialist Party Deutsche. The SPD is funded by the government, as are all political parties, and the trade unions save their money for strikes. When people go on strike, they pay proper strike pay. If you go on strike in Germany, you get full pay from the union.
Wow, sounds good. Just refresh our memories about Falkirk, because that's where this seems to have started. It was about a selection process in Falkirk as to whether the Labour Party candidate was going to be pro-union or anti, or I'm not saying anti-union actually, but more of a right-wing candidate.
Well, I mean, the Labour Party is a broad church. It's got a right-wing and a left-wing in it, as have the Liberal Democrats, as have the Conservative Party. And This row is really not helpful, but in a way, I suppose it's a row that we have to have. And ultimately, I think, basically, I'm on the union wing of the party. You know, we used to talk in the old days about the industrial wing of the movement and the political wing of the movement. I think we are relaxed about this. I'm relaxed about it. If the Labour Party doesn't want union money, the unions have got plenty of things to spend their money on instead of the Labour Party. If they don't want it, they don't have to have it.
Okay, Bristol's Chief Constable names officers over misconduct. This is in the Evening Post or the Bristol Post this week. Avon and Somerset Police Chief Constable Nick Gargan's move to name officers who face criminal charges. The move follows calls from the Bristol Post and Police Crime Commissioner Sue Mount-Stevens, who will be on this show in a few weeks' time, to identify officers involved in serious misconduct. Mr. Gargan, who was appointed by the Commissioner earlier this year, also promised to identify all officers who are charged with an offence in the future. Sylvia, what are your thoughts about this? Initially, the police said, no, we won't be naming these officers who have been charged with criminal offences, and the Chief Constable's overruled them. He said, yes, we will, and in fact, he's given a list to the Post.
I think it's perfectly reasonable to name them. I mean, the police, I mean, although they've got their uniforms, they're still just ordinary people at the end of the day, and there are good people and bad people, just the same as everywhere else in society. And this isn't something new that's only just happened in the past few years. This has been so ever since I've been around in politics for the last 35 years. And so, yes, we do get bad policemen, and why should they have anonymity? They shouldn't. They should be named, the same as any other felon will be named, and I don't have a problem with it.
In a letter to the Post, Mr. Gargan said, I believe the public has a right to expect the highest standards from its police service, and therefore the fact that the member of the service has been charged is itself a matter of public interest, even though that person may be tried at court and found not guilty. For that reason, it would in future be our policy to name members of the Avon and Somerset Constabulary who are charged with offences. In the past, Avon and Somerset Police have not tended to proactively inform the Post. Well, they're not phoning him up with a story saying one of our policemen is in court tomorrow. No. When its officers or staff have been charged with a criminal offence, it's happened on occasion, but more often than not, the Post's reporters have found out about indiscipline from other sources and then gone to the force for comment, I imagine a confirmation, before publishing a story. When a police officer is charged with an offence, the case is almost always moved to a court outside the Avon and Somerset force area to ensure the defendant has not previously known or been in contact with jurors, judges, magistrates or legal professionals involved in the case. That's one of the reasons they give, but it also makes it more difficult to report on it if, you know, you've got to go to, I don't know, Exeter or London or somewhere, Martin, to actually report on a case or to even discover that a police officer has been charged.
Yes, well, I mean, obviously I agree with Sylvia. These people, if they've broken the law, people should know about it. It reminds me of when Paul Condon took over the Met in the 1980s and he gave a press conference. He said, I'll give you the bad news. The bad news is 120 of my officers are corrupt and are working with the criminals. The good news is we know who they are and we're keeping an eye on them for you. And that is just, my uncle used to be a police officer in Birmingham, and that's the reality. That's police work. The organised criminals put a lot of effort into corrupting police officers, and sometimes they succeed. And sometimes those people have to be dealt with.
Well, is it good enough to be keeping an eye on them, Martin? It's not really. Well, I mean, if someone's a criminal, they shouldn't go to court.
What he's saying, don't forget these are all trained police officers. And when they're interviewed, they always have their lawyers with them, and so on and so forth. And we've got to do it by the book. That's what it's got to be. But you know, by the book, you catch them in the end. I mean, we're finding out, for example, about in the Lawrence, Stephen Lawrence affair, that the police were infiltrating the campaign and so on, and also the Special Demonstration Squad has been infiltrating the radical movement in this country for 30 years to the extent of actually having children with activists. Now, is that illegal? Apparently not. Should be.
Sylvia, what's your thoughts about this overall? Because, you know, we had the former Chief Constable of Cambridgeshire on this show a couple of months ago now, explaining how actually it's very difficult for some police officers. For example, they're involved in a drugs raid, they go into a place and they see great big stacks of cash lying on the table. And it's very easy for example, organised criminals to bribe police officers to say, well, here's some money, you know, why don't you take that, add it to your salary. And then all of a sudden they, you know, or slowly but surely they can get sucked into becoming criminals themselves.
Well, I have to say I have a complete lack of understanding how people can behave like that, and it's not right, and it shouldn't
be. Like the organised criminals bribing, doing the bribing?
No, the police accepting bribes. I mean, that is not what they're there for, and if that's what they're doing, they shouldn't be there, and the sooner we find out and get rid of them, the better, really. But I think it's quite right that they shouldn't be tried in the area that they're caught in, because they are deserving of a fair trial, and that they will receive if they're sent somewhere else. And if it's an inconvenience to the Post or whoever to go somewhere else, well, so be it.
Interesting. Right, well, back to unions again, and they're planning to take on the coalition in a wave of strikes in defiance of the lobbying bill. This is trade unions. This is preparing to take on the government. This is in the Mirror. A long-running battle that could include a coordinated wave of strikes and calculated defiance of the lobbying bill. On the eve of the TUC's annual conference, its General Secretary Francis O'Grady claims there's unprecedented unity amongst unions in the face of what they see as a series of threats to their own and their members' interests. So this isn't just ordinary charities, this is trade unions, and there's some serious problems with this lobbying bill, apparently. Firefighters have already voted to strike over pension rights, and the Communication Workers Union balloting its members over whether to strike and protest against plans to privatise the Royal Mail, and the teachers too. Now, it seems like, you know, we could be looking at a sort of wave of strikes, and this lobbying bill seems just another reason for unions to get us upset. Now, this was one of the things discussed, because they're back, if you, in case you hadn't noticed, the Council of Commons are back this week at Prime Minister's Questions, with a question from Margaret Beckett.
This is Margaret Beckett.
Why does the Prime Minister believe that his plans to restrict lobbying are opposed by organisations from the Salvation Army, Countryside Alliance, Oxfam, the British Leader, and so on, right through to Conservative Home?
Well, I was listening to the exchanges before I came in for Prime Minister's Questions, and it seems to me there's a concerted lobbying campaign being run by the trade unions, who mysteriously managed to convince Member of Parliament after Member of Parliament opposite to raise this problem. We all know what's going on. They don't want the trade unions brought within the law. They want the trade unions to go on spending millions after millions trying to alter an election campaign rather than having them properly controlled by the law. That's what the lobbying bill's about.
Well, and also yesterday's announced that the flawed lobbying bill should be withdrawn, says a committee of MPs. The government's lobbying reforms are flawed and should be withdrawn for 6 months while they're improved. A report from the Cross-Party Political and Constitutional Reform Committee said the lobbying bill had been unnecessarily rushed. Now, Sylvia, this was a much vaunted initiative of David Cameron's. He said that this was the next big scandal waiting to happen, and yet the bill he's brought in to control and set up a register of lobbyists so everyone knows who's going in out of Westminster, twisting the arms of our politicians. It's going to be affecting charities and trade unions, it seems, more than some of the richer lobbyists.
Yeah, well, I'm no fan of David Cameron, am I? I'm a Liberal Democrat, so I don't hold any great hopes of what he's doing.
He'll be relying on your party's support to get this through.
Yes, but I think that if you're going to do a lobbying bill, you've got to take time over it. And I have to say that lobbying, Even by charities, one has to be very careful about lobbying. It can be quite an invidious thing, and can cause, I think, businesses are the main problem. But I think the thing with lobbying is it should be very much more transparent, and I think we need to take a lot more time to think about it. I realise that charities do rely a lot upon lobbying, but it's got to be fair for all sides, so it can't just be charities get special treatment and businesses don't. It's got to be the same rule for everybody,
but
I think.
Businesses have got more money than charities, and generally speaking, the way things work is the more money that's thrown at a bit of lobbying, the more successful it's going to be in getting a new law passed.
Well, clearly, we've got to kind of bring it under control, but I think we need to take a bit more time to think about it if we're going to get... We really need all party support. It's not much good. It seems to me that the Labour Party are setting up to oppose this. I'm not sure, to be perfectly honest, if all of the Liberal Democrat MPs are on board on this either. So I think we need to take a bit more time and step back a bit and think about a bit harder about how we're going to do it.
But then, of course, that means that still nothing's going to be done about it. It's going to be kicking it down the road another few years.
Well, 6 months, you know, a six-month wait is to get the thing right. Doesn't seems to me not unreasonable.
Martin?
Yeah, well, we were talking about money in politics earlier. I mean, it is the nub of the matter, because, of course, what's actually happening, and you can see it very clearly in the US, is that money controls the political process. Mm. Quite clear, no doubt about it. In 1992, the Conservative Party got a cheque for £17.5 million drawn on the Bank of Jersey. General Wild Boar Smith, who was their party treasurer, turned up at the Tory party HQ with a cheque on the Bank of Jersey for £17.5 million. Now, the information we're getting, inside information, about Doug Hoyle asked a question about this in the House of Commons. Where did that money come from? We suspect it's something to do with the sale of South Africa's nuclear weapons.
So?
Well, I'm just telling you, this is, I'm getting inside information. That's where the money came from.
Well, that's a bit of a strong accusation you're making.
It is a strong accusation. That's why I'm making it, Tony.
But, I mean, maybe... I mean, I'm just wondering, because it's a bit like we were talking about the Swiss bank account earlier, isn't it? I mean, at the moment, we don't really necessarily know where this money's coming from, do we, Sylvia?
Well, I guess we don't. I think that some of the exposés have been done on lobbying. I think this is encouraging certain individuals to get at MPs and to their disadvantage, and there's no way about it. Money talks, but we've got to make a bill so that money doesn't talk. It's got to be, but it's got to be a sensible one that works and is and a transparent one.
Unfortunately, we've got this kind of partisan approach, which the Conservatives, since the general strike in 1926, the Conservative Party has been trying to defund the Labour Party by taking away the union's money. Now, in actual fact, I think the model has got to be like Scandinavia, where the unions have their money to pay for people when they go on strike or whatever, and the political process, all the parties, should be on a level playing field, all funded by the state, and of course with PR. That's an absolutely essential thing.
Okay, well, we'll see how this all goes in another 6 months. It's certainly, I mean, I hate to be so cynical, but having seen the way that Cameron dealt with this originally, it was like he didn't really want to do it. Now he's got another excuse to leave it for another 6 months before he does anything. Another look at Prime Minister's questions, and this time the bedroom tax, the unsustainable no evictions policy. Well, this wasn't actually at Prime Minister's questions, but it was a question related to it, set to be scrapped. This is the Bristol Post yesterday. And no eviction policy for Bristol's council tenants, which was introduced as a result of the so-called bedroom tax, looks to be scrapped. A working party was set up to examine the effects of the tax. It's now revealed its findings. It says the policy is not sustainable and should be ended as soon as possible. Well, this is a very unenlightening article, so it doesn't explain who this working party is. Do you know anything about this working party, Sylvia? Who are they?
It was an all-party working party.
And who's on it, do you know?
I don't know who's on it, no. I should have perhaps informed myself better, but all I know is it will be from all of the political parties that are sitting on it. And this was set up by Mayor Ferguson, of course, to look into what is going on. But the whole thing is a total nonsense, because the bedroom tax and evictions, it's all a big red herring, because there are loads and loads and loads of people sitting in large houses that are having to pay extra money on the bedroom tax, and it's absolutely splendid for them to say, that's fine, we'll give up our property, we'll go somewhere else, and we have nowhere to give them. There are no smaller properties to put them into. So it's another flawed policy by the government, to be perfectly honest. But the difficulty with the evictions or the non-evictions is that other people are getting in on the bandwagon now and obviously claiming that they can't afford to pay the extra money, and the arrears are going up enormously, and of course the council has an obligation to collect the money in, so it's in a bit of a mess really.
Well, the one thing the Post has actually got some figures on is those arrears, which have gone up from 1,400 accounts in arrears to more than 2,200 in June, and the total level of arrears has increased from 585,000 in April to nearly 700,000 in June. So obviously the people aren't able to pay the rent because the bedroom tax is there. The council's policy for managing rent arrears is to support tenants in holding on to their homes. It focuses on early intervention and eviction used as a last resort, but the working party said a no eviction policy is unworkable. Well, before we hear from Martin on this, let's go to the House of Commons and a question asked by Jim Hood about the mansion tax and the bedroom tax.
Mr. Jim Hood.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister says he does not support a mansion tax for people living in mansions over £2 million, because he claims some people living in these £2 million mansions are capital rich and cash poor. Can the Prime Minister tell me, how does he round that circle with his support for the bedroom tax, where he is punishing poor who are capital poor and who have no cash?
I think, first of all, he has to get clear what is a tax and what isn't a tax. Currently, before our changes, there was a subsidy for people who had additional rooms they weren't using, and we believe it's fair to have the same rules in private sector rented accommodation and in council accommodation. But the question is now for Labour. You've ranted and raved about the spare room subsidy. Are you going to reverse it? Just nod. Is he going to reverse it? You're going to reverse it? Spare room subsidy? That means no, that means yes. Any chance? Absolutely nothing to say and weak at the same time with it.
Well, that's David Cameron then replying to the question about the bedroom tax and the mansion tax, Martin. First of all, though, what is going on with Labour's policy? Because there isn't any proper commitment. Then there's some sort of slightly flaky saying, we'll do it when the time is right. We may do it when the time is right. But there's been no unequivocal commitment to get rid of this bedroom tax. It would seem to be a bit of a no-brainer for getting votes in the next election.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they've been fairly solid in saying that they are going
to
repeal it.
No, they're not. No, I mean, I'll correct you if you want.
If I was in charge, I would repeal it. I mean, of course,
you're not.
Well, I'm not. I'm just on the radio. But the fact of the matter is, you see, if you remove people from social housing and council housing, they're going to private rented, then you're going to have to double the housing benefit you pay to those people. I'm in private rented. It's a totally inadequate sort of place, but I have to pay probably double what you're paying in your social housing, Tony. And of course, if you were evicted from your social housing, as many people will be, my sister's probably going to be evicted from her social housing for the bedroom tax, then we'll put them in private rented, and then the housing benefit bill will go up. And in any case, this is simply class war from the top to the bottom. Yeah. We've got to have some class war from the bottom to the top.
Well, it does make you wonder what's going on. It's like the Sheriff of Nottingham, Sylvia. It's like the poorest, the people who are least able to deal with the situation are supposedly the ones who are the bad guys, and they've got to do something, they've got to pay more money, but they don't have that money. They've got to then go out into the jobs market. Only trouble is, it's very difficult to get jobs. There's a lot of competition from abroad and from migrant workers to get those jobs. And even if you do get a job, as we were about to hear from another question, Prime Minister's question, real wages are down something like £1,500 since the general election.
Yeah, I think it's an absolute scandal, really, that the poorest in society are being told, well, you've got a room to many, so you've got to pay extra money on it or get out, particularly when there's nowhere for them to get out to.
So is David Cameron really the Sheriff of Nottingham?
Well, yes, I think he is.
And so why are you in a coalition with him? You're in the castle too, aren't you?
No, I don't think we are. Because you were part of a coalition, it doesn't mean to say that you have to agree with everything that coalition is doing. We're in a coalition of convenience because the country is bankrupt. It's as simple as that. I don't think any Liberal Democrat is happy at having to go into coalition with any party. But it was a question of, do we care about this country? And the answer is yes, we do. And do we want to try and get it out of the mess it's in? Yes, we do. And the only way to do that was to go into coalition with one party. And the only party that was large enough at the time was the Conservative Party. It's not a kind of marriage of happiness. It's a marriage of convenience that will last just until the next election.
So, Martin, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think actually what could have happened at the general election is what happened in Scotland when the SNP got the plurality, but they didn't have enough to govern on their own. No party wanted to go into coalition with them, so Alex Salmond had to run his government in Scotland as a minority government. So every bill that he brought forward, he had to build a coalition for it. And I think the Liberal Democrats could and should have not gone into coalition with the Conservatives. I mean, I think they're very much very important part of the political landscape. I'm personally passionately in favour of PR, because if we had PR, we wouldn't be talking.
Yes, but we're not talking about PR or anything. No, we're talking about the national debt. The national debt is now approaching $1.2 trillion. That's risen 7.5% in just 1 year. Nothing whatsoever is being done to stop that and to actually rein back that debt. All this talk about the deficit, the national debt is still going up and up and up at an incredible rate.
Yes, that's because the banking system is a black hole, and you can chuck as much money at it as you like, and it will carry on soaking it up. That is why the public accounts are in the red in Britain and everywhere else over the world, because we bailed out the private banking system. Now, if it's,
yes, but you can't undo these decisions.
When we nationalise the banks, we should have nationalised them. And that means that we should run them.
We did nationalise them.
No, we didn't. We just given them We've just given them money and told them to get on with it. And of course, they've just blown another bubble, bigger than the bubble in 2008. And the Labour front bench have got to get their heads around this. There is going to be a further crash. And the whole political class is going to be swept away like a tsunami.
Sylvia, what do you think about this? The national debt figure now approaching 1.2 trillion, up 7.5% in 1 year. Now, we keep hearing, oh, the deficit, we're making progress with the deficit. Actually, they're not really, are they? Because the national debt is still going up and up. It's just not going up at quite as fast as it was last year.
I think we're making some progress in as much as we're paying off the interest on it. And I think that is... it's coming down in that respect.
No, but we're not. But, we're not paying off the interest. We are. All we're doing is we're making a tiny hole in the interest. The compound interest means that that money is getting more and more. The debt is getting bigger, and it's because we can't pay off the interest that it's doing that.
I think until the economy picks up a lot more, and we've got more people in work, and we're actually producing more, it is going to be very, very difficult to get out of this. And we're suffering from not just something that happened when we took control as a coalition. This is based on sort of 10 years in Labour and quite a lot of Mrs. Thatcher prior to that. Yeah. This is something that's been building up for years and years and years. And the fact that we're being told it might be 5 years, 7 years, 10 years to get out of it is not of any surprise to me whatsoever, when we've been something like 25 years getting into it.
Well, I wonder if even in that we would manage to turn the corner. But anyway, the United Nations has sent in a special rapporteur, Raquel Rolnick, to inspect the bedroom tax. A senior UN official is in the UK at the invitation of the government to examine whether the bedroom tax would impact on human rights. Article 25 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights includes housing as part of the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family. That's just a quote from Article 25. The UK has voiced its commitment to human rights on repeated occasions, and this mission will give me an opportunity, she says, to assess in depth to what extent adequate housing is a central aspect of the right to an adequate standard of living, is the core of this commitment, Sylvia.
Well, I think they're using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. I mean, it just needs a bit of common sense from David Cameron, quite frankly, to realise that what he's done is not a workable thing. But yes, she could look into it. I'm not sure it infringes your human rights that you should have extra space.
What, to be evicted?
Oh, to be evicted is most certainly infringing your human rights.
And, you know, and that's what happens if you can't pay your rent.
Well, obviously, the problem with eviction is the council then has a responsibility to actually rehouse people. So it's not doing any council, and it isn't just Bristol City Council, it's not doing any council any favours that we've got to evict people, because we then have to house them.
Well, I live near the shelter office in Bristol, and I've had people knocking on my door today by mistake, looking for the shelter office, our whole family. They've got nowhere to live, simple as that. And also, there's lots and lots of single people, particularly younger single people, who the council don't seem to have any responsibility to house, because the waiting list is so massive. We've got between 15 and 19,000 on the housing register in Bristol. So how on earth is someone who's homeless and goes knocking on the door of the council actually going to get somewhere to live?
Well, I think with great difficulty, as was being said, it's going to have to be private rented, which is out of most people's sort of range. I mean, I also have noticed, I live on the harbour side, and I've also noticed a lot more people at night sleeping rough around the harbour side, under the shelters and things like that, and it is a very distressing thing, and it's quite a problem. But the government have got to have a complete rethink of what they've done. It's causing a lot of anxiety and debt, and problems for other councils, because we can't solve it.
Well, I will have a go next week to get somebody from that working group on the show next week to find out what on earth, why they think it's a good idea to be evicting people under the bedroom tax, even though it's going to cost the council more.
I don't think they think it's a good idea to be evicting people, but they're
guessing. But if it costs more, surely, you know, that's a bit of a no-brainer, isn't it? If they're going to have to pay more in housing benefit because someone's in the private sector, then they would have had to pay a little bit extra for the bedroom tax. Anyway, Martin, I mean, the big developers, how does this fit in the big macroeconomic world? Why is it that there aren't enough homes out there for people?
Well, a Conservative government in the 1950s, the Macmillan government, actually built the largest number of council houses. It was not, in fact, a Labour government that did that. Mm. And there was a general consensus in the 1950s across the political spectrum that Owner occupation was for some people the wealthy.
So what's
people,
the motivation in keeping the number of houses less than the number of people that need them?
The whole thing from the Thatcher government decided that they were going to put the kibosh on social housing and council housing, because of course they saw people living in council houses as tied Labour voters. I mean, I used to live in Putney, and at the end of the war, Herbert Morrison was running the Greater London Council, and they rehoused all of the people from the East End in Putney. So Putney used to be a conservative seat, and Herbert Morrison said to the local Conservative, "We're building you out, Hughie. We're building you out." And of course, they did build him out. They put all the people from the East End into Putney, and it became a Labour seat, which Peter Hain used to represent, and that's. That's why the Conservatives don't like council housing, because if the Labour government gives you a nice house at a reasonable rent, you're likely to vote for them.
Well, it's actually probably the most important thing in most people's lives, their home, isn't it? Yes. And if the government sorts that out for you, Macmillan
in the 50s, when he said you've never had it so good to the working class, that's because the Conservatives had got the message. We've got to do things to help people who are not necessarily going to vote for us, but we're going to help them anyway. And that was a different era. What's happened is the politicised... I mean, we've now got this help-to-buy scheme that Osborne's come up with, which basically subsidises the people already on the property ladder are going to be subsidised to trade up. Meanwhile, the people on the bottom of the ladder are going to be evicted. It's class warfare. Class warfare. I don't think they're going to try it in Northern Ireland because the bombs might start going off.
Right, back to Prime Minister's questions as I promised, and it's just John Mann now looking at the real wages, which have gone down, he says, £1,500 for every individual in the country on average since the general election in 2010.
Mr. Mann, is it not the case that real wages have fallen by nearly £1,500 a year since he became Prime Minister?
Yeah. That's right.
Of course we live in tough times because of the incredible mess that we've had to clear up from the party opposite. But I have to say, the party opposite complaining about the economy, complaining about living standards, is like the arsonist complaining to the fire brigade. Yeah. Because it's this government that's turning the economy round, and that's the way we'll get living standards up.
Well, I have to say, well, I don't have to say anything, but I will say, it certainly doesn't seem to be turning the economy around when you look at the figures for the national debt I read out earlier on. 1.2 trillion and rising at 7.5% in a year. I mean, this is not turning the economy around, Sylvia, is it?
It's not. I have to say that wages for people who are actually out at work, well, indeed for retired people, have undoubtedly fallen. I think some of the things that have scandalised me and really upset me in a way is that people have been on frozen wages. The national insurance has actually been increased, so that's like a wage cut. And then for some people have lost their family allowance, most unfairly, to be perfectly honest, because you could earn £40,000 and keep it. If you earn £60,000, you lose it. But you could be two families on £30,000 and keep it, but only one family earning £60,000 and you lose it. There seems to me gross unfairness in the way it's being dished out. And, you know, I have personal experience of this within my families of this happening, so that the actual take-home money is actually less than it was. It's not just a wage freeze, but national insurance gone up and child allowance has disappeared. It seems to me that people are very much worse off. But as a pensioner, I do believe that we have been helped. I can't actually say that we have been disadvantaged, because the rises that pensioners get are greater, and we're given extra bonuses of winter fuel allowances, and when you get to over 75, free television. So we do get more help as older people, but I think the people that are really suffering are younger people with families, and I do think that is of considerable concern to me.
Martin, how long can we go on at this sort of rate? £1,500 real drop in income for the average family in the last couple of years?
Well, the fundamental problem with the way the capitalist system has evolved over the last 30 or 40 years is that real wages haven't risen in the United States of America since 1973. Think about that. We're now in 2013, so since 1973, real wages haven't risen. Now, in a capitalist economy, because of productivity, because of technological change, you expect productivity to rise on average about 3% a year. Mm. Now, what used to happen, and still does happen in Scandinavia, is that that should be paid out as wage increases. If you think back to the good old days when we were children, Tony, people's wages rose year on year. Yeah? we can think back to the 60s, people got more goods. Real wages were rising, and we were
recovering from a sort of wartime austerity, weren't we?
Well, yes, but the point is that the Swedish system developed by Meidner in the 30s, which they implemented there, they've got 90% of people in Sweden are in trade unions. 90%. They don't have lots of strikes. They don't need to have strikes because they're in control of the country. And they make damn sure that everybody, they have what they call solidaristic bargaining, so that the stronger sections, like the engineers, for example, they said what they used to do is they get the trade unions, they insisted that the employers have an employers' federation, because they didn't have an employers' federation in Sweden. And the Landsarna Ogstag said, you've got to have an employers' federation. We're not negotiating with individual employers. So they forced them to have an employers' federation. And what they would do every year is they would sit down, the union's economists and the boss's economists would sit down, and they would agree what the productivity increase had been for the year. And then the unions would push for that as a pay increase across the board. Now, what was clever about this is that some companies will actually have a bigger productivity increase, and some companies have a lower productivity increase. But what you do is the companies which are investing in the future and investing in their workforce, they get a little boost because they've got productivity increase of maybe 5%, but they've only got to pay a 3% wage increase. The poor companies, which are badly managed, have perhaps only got a 1% productivity increase. They've still got to pay 3% because the goal is to bankrupt the rubbish companies. And this is what people say, oh, but I've got a little company here and I'm putting some people to work. In Scandinavia, we don't want rubbish companies that can't pay top wages. And of course, this is what's gone wrong. The capitalist class have forced wages down across the world. And then, of course, what they've done is they've killed off the customers. Because those workers are the people that have to buy. And if you keep forcing their wages down, they can't buy the stuff they produce, can they?
Well, it sounds an interesting idea that the system is sort of biting off the hands that feeds it, Sylvia. Mm. What do you make of that?
I can't actually agree with that, I have to say. I think that because we're in harder times, and there's absolutely no doubt that this country is a bankrupt country, and Europe is not doing that well either, and certainly the United States isn't. So we're in almost a world recession, and we have got to cut back to do it. But I think the people...
James wouldn't agree with you.
Just Martin, hang on.
I think the people who are going to suffer are the younger generation, because it's the fact that they've got... It's what's going to hand it on to our children, my grandchildren. What are they going to be inheriting? I know my children now are going to be inheriting very much less pensions than I have inherited from when I worked for all my life. And their children, are they going to inherit jobs? How are they going to educate them? University now, you've got to take out massive great mortgages to send your kids to university. And if you don't, they're going to be, for the rest of their lives, paying it off. It's a very serious situation we've got in, and how we're actually going to get out of it is very difficult. And in a way,
I mean, it's up to your politician. You know, your party's got to come up with some answers. I mean, if we're looking at the national debt, the way it's increasing at the moment, by 2020, it's going to be topping $2 trillion, and it's just going to keep going up. And of course, the more the national debt is, we are just working and working, paying our taxes just simply to pay off we're not actually paying off the interest, just to try and keep up the interest payments, which we can't keep up.
Well, I think the difficulty is you've got to make a decision. Are you going to start investing in the infrastructure, sort of Keynesian strategy, whereby you're going to actually make work and try and artificially inflate things so that people have got jobs and more money flows in? It's not a thing that I, just as a pavement politician, and that's all I am, can even answer. It's right out of my kind of understanding of how we get our heads around this kind of sums of money.
Well, one of the effects of this is war veteran, 99 years old, lay helpless on his floor for 2 days after his intercom checks were axed. The former Desert Rat previously received 3 checks for housing, but housing chiefs brought in the new charge because of council cuts. The Second World War hero was laying helpless on the floor of his flat more than 48 hours after a daily intercom check on him was axed to save 42 pence a day. Former Desert Rat Harold Lee, 99, had previously received the free cheques and his sheltered accommodation block. Housing chiefs brought the new change because the council cuts in financial support as part of the agreement when he moved into his flat in Derby, Martin.
Well, I mean, this is obviously a tragic story, and it's the Daily Mirror, of course.
But it's 42 pence a day.
Yes, I know.
I mean, this is ridiculous, isn't it?
In Cyprus, we talked about this the other week, the president of Cyprus gave a speech the other week where he said, what we're going to do is we're going to provide a citizen's income for every Cypriot person. We're just going to give people, and the Grillisti in Italy are demanding this as well, we want €1,000 per head. We've got to rethink.
For nothing. You can't have money for nothing.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Because you get rid of things like mortgage tax relief, which allows the middle class. I mean, the middle class leave university, get on the housing ladder.
Then why shouldn't they?
They don't do it in Germany. House prices haven't risen in Germany.
But why shouldn't people get on the housing ladder when they leave university?
Because it's just because we got so used to this way of doing things in Britain that we don't see how perverse it is. It's just perverse.
Well, I don't think it's perverse to try and want a house when you leave university.
No, but nobody should be investing in housing as a way to make themselves wealthy.
No, but they might wish to own their own home. I don't think there's any problem with that.
The mortgage tax relief was brought in by the Conservative government in the 1920s to encourage people to buy their own houses, because once people are on mortgages, for example, they would be very unwilling to go on strike.
So would you like everyone to be living in a council house?
Well, I mean, it's not inconceivable. I mean, you go to Scandinavia and you will find that quite wealthy people live in social housing. It's normal stuff over there.
Well, another aspect to all of this, David Cameron's £2.4 billion universal credit project riddled with problems. This is The Guardian yesterday. The flagship programme of welfare changes has been poorly managed and riddled with major IT problems, while its cost could escalate by hundreds of millions of pounds, according to a very critical report by the government's official auditors released yesterday. National Audit Office said Universal Credit, the £2.4 billion project, meant to consolidate six different welfare payments into one, has been beset by weak management, ineffective control and poor governance. Martin, what's your thoughts on this, and your particularly on the government's ability when it comes to IT projects to do with the welfare system?
Well, the idea of a universal credit, this is exactly what the Cypriot president was talking about. It's a universal credit. We just give you the money. And then, of course, you can work on top of that.
No, but this isn't what this is. No, this is they're not trying to check everything in real time.
The absurdity of what Ian Duncan Smith is trying to do here is that he wants people to work part-time or full-time or whatever, and then the credit will be withdrawn. So Sylvie was talking about the £10,000 tax. That's tax. But of course the universal credit cuts against that. So, you know, the Liberal Democrat policy of reducing tax on the low paid is going to be undermined completely by the right hand of universal credit, which is actually, leaving aside the fact that it's a shambles and they don't know what they're doing, it's the people at the bottom in this society are being kicked very hard.
Well, I think the theory that no one should be worse off by working is a very reasonable theory. So I could see the universal credit that could top them up if they're still working. I actually saw quite an interesting interview by in an area where it is being trialled, by asking somebody if she knew about it, and she was in receipt of it, and what she had said was how much simpler it had been for her to get it. So I think the actual principle,
that's not always the case with these government IT projects though, is it?
No, but the principle behind what they're trying to do is a good principle, but I think that IT things always seem to run into great difficulties. Now Ian Duncan Smith says he's sorted a lot of them, although not entirely believing of that, but I think the idea of a universal credit is a good one. Trying to get IT systems to work is another thing, and it seems to me nearly all of these, like the National Health Service system, and that seems to have crashed as well. So any big IT thing has got a lot of teething problems.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove, Sylvia Doble. After the news, we hear from the big hitters in the blue corner. It's John Kerry. In the red corner, Vladimir Putin. Also, what do the US veterans think about it all? Join us after the news.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.